Thanks, Ken. So I'd like to start pretty much where I ended up yesterday's talk. Yesterday I sort of gave a kind of probably a rather very fast overview of some of the trends that took place over the last 100 years in probability, big territory to cover. Today it'll be a little bit more focused on things that have happened over, I guess, the last approximately 30 years. And in this period of time, of course, the whole theory of stochastic processes and probability in finite dimensional spaces was by that time very well developed. But in the period since then, the study of systems which are more complex, systems that are distributed in space, systems that have a hierarchical or combinatorial structure, have been the subject of much of the very interesting developments that have taken place. So I mentioned yesterday, just at the end, something which does go back quite a bit before that period, the Ising model, which is a very important model in statistical physics. But it also sort of served as the launching pad for a lot of very interesting mathematical developments. And the mathematical formulation of the Ising model was done in terms of what is called the Gibbs random field, which, oh, I don't have the today. But anyway, the Gibbs random field, which is basically given by a probability law with this form, where here H is an energy, and that is basically the definition of Gibbs measure. But the mathematical structure of this corresponds to what is a Markov random field, which is the, as I mentioned yesterday, sort of the generalization of the idea of the Markov property, which, remember, was simply saying that future and past are conditionally independent given the present, to saying that if I'm interested in the distribution at this site and I condition on everything outside this site, then I only need to know the neighboring sites. That's, of course, when we have the in the previous slide, the JIJs were nearest neighbors. So in other words, the only terms that came into the quadratic form were the nearest neighbors. Or another way to put it is, if I conditioned on the boundary sites, the interior and exterior are conditionally independent. And that structure is a very important structure, but also very rigid. And I don't know the exact chronology and exactly who did what, but anyway, in the school developed in the United States of Frank Spitzer and in the former Soviet Union by Dobryshin, the whole mathematical theory of Markov random fields was developed, and the relationship with dynamics that went with them. So the dynamics that goes with the Markov random field is the notion of detailed balance, which goes back in statistical physics. So the equilibrium, so in other words, this course, the random field you get here is an equilibrium for a dynamics. And the dynamics that corresponds to Markov random field property is very structured, and it was characterized by Spitzer and perhaps others as well. Exactly what possible sets of dynamics correspond to the Markov random field, it involves simply the detailed balance simply means that it implies that if in fact I want to find the equilibrium distribution condition and everything else, I just look at the equilibrium for the fixed values of the sites, the detailed balance. It involves just looking at the two energies. If I change the, of course, these are just plus and minus one, so if I look at the two energies with the plus one and the minus one, it has a special form, the rate at which the two transitions take place. It's very rigid. And those were characterized by Spitzer, and in particular for the Ising model, so-called Glober dynamics. Now, what I said on this slide from statistical physics to statistics, because, in fact, some ideas that, somehow come out of this, basic ideas of statistical physics and Markov random fields and so on, have percolated in and, in fact, form probably much of the motivation for this whole methodology, which we now call Markov chain Monte Carlo, where you have structured, where you want to find, be able to sample from a complex distribution and to use the idea that you'll find a Markov chain whose stationary distribution is the required distribution. And in fact, some of the standard procedures are very much inspired by the, for example, the Glober dynamics, for example, Gibbs sampler, and some of the Markov chain Monte Carlo methods, which now have very many important applications in Bayesian networks and machine learning and so on. It's a huge area, very important area, and close relations with the ideas of statistical physics. Well, the mathematics that came out of the studying of the Ising model, some very deep mathematics. And for example, yesterday I mentioned that the Ising model has the property. Remember that the energy is such that the favored configurations are those where the spins all point in the same direction. And the idea is if the temperature is low, you can be frozen into an infinite configuration where most of the spins are in one direction. But if you raise the temperature, then at some point that the magnetization, so-called Curie point magnetization, disappears. And mathematically, oh, there is one. Mathematically, the study, what happens exactly at the critical point, is a very beautiful and deep problem. And, well, many of these phenomena are very much then dependent on what dimension you're in. And it turns out for the Ising model, that the question is whether dimension is less than 4 or bigger than 4, what happens at the critical point? So if you look at the critical point, and now you look at the fluctuations on large scales, for high dimensions, d bigger than 4, then the fluctuations are Gaussian, so-called Gaussian universality class. But as you go to dimension d minus epsilon, well, in some sense, one would have to make precise what we mean by dimension 4 minus epsilon. But this, well, there's a mathematical framework called renormalization group in which the notion of dimension, fractional dimension, is introduced. And for as you go through dimension d equals 4, the universality class, which corresponds to the Gaussian fixed point of a mapping. Once again, this is described by the fixed point of a mapping, as I tried to explain yesterday with the central limit theorem. So there's a mapping there, a nonlinear mapping, that at the critical temperature and at the critical dimension 4, there's a bifurcation to two universality, or two or more universality classes. So these are very deep results, originally obtained by Blaher and Sinai. And, well, it's a very, very big subject. It was, these things were proved rigorously, of course, in a idealized situation called the Dyson's hierarchical model, which is a kind of a caricature of dimension, and in which you have dimensions that are fractional dimensions. Anyway, very beautiful mathematical subject. And, well, the mathematics in this whole area is incredibly difficult and has stimulated many interesting developments. Now, spin glass model is perhaps one of the most beautiful models in statistical physics and probability. Well, here we have, of course, energy, as I mentioned here, the J's are, well, the Ising model corresponds to what I said yesterday, J's would just simply be positive, say, constant. Well, Jij is plus 1 if, say, I minus J is 1. But if instead of that you choose the Jijs to be random, for example, Gaussian random variables, then essentially at each site there will be a different, you know, some of them will be plus and some will be minus. And when they're plus, it means you would like to line up opposite spins. And when they're plus, you want to line up similar spins. When Jij is negative, you want to line up negative spins. And it turns out, of course, that essentially, to get a maximum energy, there are many, many constraints, and you can't satisfy all the constraints. It leads to a phenomenon called frustration. And the whole mathematical theory of studying spin glasses has given rise to, in recent years, both at the dynamical and at the equilibrium levels, very, very profound and beautiful results. Okay, well, I guess, yeah, that's probably good for the next slide now. Okay, so now, of course, as I mentioned in the Ising model and those models in statistical physics, there was a constraint which basically had this time reversibility, or equivalently this detailed balance condition, which is a very strong condition, and as I mentioned, Spitzer sort of characterized. Well, there are many other models that are sort of have the same general framework, but that don't satisfy those conditions, very many natural models. And Spitzer, way back in the 70s, introduced this whole idea of interacting particle systems, which turned out to be a very, very rich class of things where you can model many complex phenomenon. And sort of there is a whole class of, you know, simple, we call maybe baby models, where we have some mechanism that we can describe mathematically. And of course, the idea is eventually one is interested in more complex systems. So for example, I mentioned here a number. I mean, this whole set of systems, you think of a lattice, or it could be a graph, a more general graph. It doesn't have to be a lattice. And at each site, you're going to have a system which could be in a finite number of states, or maybe an infinite number of states. And at each site, then, the dynamics is going to be, locally, there's going to be some dynamical activity taking place, which I will mention in different cases. And also, I'm going to be looking at models where either you can think of the population of individuals at each site, and then the individuals can also move from site to site, migration. So basically, these would be situations where there would be two mechanisms. One would be, at each site, some kind of dynamical mechanism, interaction. And also, you would either have a collection of individuals or a continuum with mass flowing between the different sites. So for example, the Voder model, which is maybe one of the simplest of these models, at each site, you would have one of two opinions. Well, here I have two colors. And at some random times, the opinion, you can switch your opinion. You can simply, at some random time, pick one of the opinions of your four neighbors. And then you let the thing evolve. So it would simply be a system, two opinions. And each site, in continuous time, will, at some constant rate, pick one of the four neighbors and then switch to the opinion of that neighbor. Well, branching random walk, that's a system where you have a population of particles which can move between the sites. So there would be two mechanisms there. The particle can either move according to, say, a random walk from site to site, or at a given site, and I'll look at essentially the case of critical branching just because it's the simplest case, a particle can either die or branch into two particles, and then the process continues. The contact process is a kind of variation of that. Stepping stone model is an important model I'll come to later in genetics, where you have at each site a finite number of types or an infinite number of types, and at each site there's going to be finite population sampling. It's sort of the basic genetic sampling that we study. And then, of course, something I'm interested in now is multi-agent systems. You can have sort of intelligent agents at each site, and basically they can be trying to explore an environment. So there are many, many things. These things are now used to model things like internet dynamics or spatial economies or urban growth models. So it's a rich family of models to describe interacting systems. Okay, well, here's sort of the mathematical framework in the simplest form. You'll simply have at each site, and I'm going to take D-dimensional lattice. you're going to have a state. So xi of t is simply the state at time t at the site I, and this could be either a real, I mean, the state could be real valued, or it could be a vector, or it could be in some finite set. And you have two mechanisms, migration between sites according to a random walk, and some stochastic dynamics with interaction within each site. And the one I mentioned already is simply the case where you would have particles that could either die, well, if I use this notation delta, just think of this as a delta function at x, or particle at x, can either die with probability 1/2, or it can branch and produce an offspring with probability 1/2. So this is a very, very simple model, the branching process model, but it's extremely important because it captures the basic biological mechanism of reproduction. And when you have this, then you have not only that you produce two ancestors, but each individual then has a parent, and there's the ancestral structure, which is implicit there, which can be made explicit, which will be made explicit at a later point. Okay, well, what of our basic tools? Okay, so, of course, this family of systems I mentioned, you can write down prescriptions for very complex and interesting dynamics, internet dynamics, or spatial economy, and so on. Of course, mathematically, the question is, can we get any information? Of course, many of these things a priori are not tractable in the sense we can't solve any specific equations. So by and large, there are two strategies. One strategy is simulation. And simulation is extremely powerful, but simulation is not always, you know, there's something which simulation can't quite do, which I think is best captured by that picture of phase transition for the Ising model. The Ising model is something, the phenomenon of phase transition is something which you can only make mathematically precise in the infinite limit. So you have to work with an infinite system. Of course, simulation cannot simulate infinite systems. So the current strategy is more or less to look at simulation methods for finite systems, to look at mathematical analysis, rigorous mathematical analysis of certain admittedly simplified classes of infinite systems, and then something which I'll probably mention again at the very end if I have time, to understand the relation between infinite systems and finite systems in a mathematical framework. And there's some very interesting ideas on exactly, you know, to what extent does an infinite system approximate a finite system, or you can look at it the other way around. To what extent can a simulation of a finite system tell you something about the infinite system? Okay, well, the other thing is, well, in doing this, we also like to look at systems in different, I mean, we look at a system in a small scale or in a big scale, and the mathematical technique, of course, is basically to look at asymptotics, to look at things in large scales, either in space or in time or in both. So this is a simple example where one can carry through the analysis. So we can look at, here I'm looking at the branching, starting with this. Wasn't so good. Sorry. Starting with the branching random walk. Starting with the branching, critical branching, binary branching random walk, we're going to now, of course, this is on this lattice. And when we have a large population, now we can look at the large-scale behavior of this, just as when we take, for example, ordinary differential equation models for growth. So we now want to look at this in a large-scale point of view, so we're going to do a space-time mass scaling. So roughly speaking, we shrink the grid down so that the spacing between the grid points root epsilon, and we speed up time by a factor of 1 over epsilon, and we give mass to each particle of mass epsilon. So this is sort of space-time mass rescaling. And now if in one dimension we do this, one dimensional, just Z1, and we look at what happens when we let epsilon go to 0, we end up getting a process in time and space, and the process is, well, the limit is going to be xt of little x. It's going to be a solution with a density in the limit. So you're going to have a function-valued solution, just as you would like when you look at the heat equation. And here you would have, if you like, you can think of this as a randomly perturbed heat equation, where the first term is this is nothing but the heat equation. So if we didn't have the branching mechanism, I probably should have put a parameter there. If we had no branching, then we just get the heat equation out of this process. But because of the branching mechanism, critical branching mechanism rescaled, there's also going to be fluctuations of the population coming from this term here. Now, the question is, what does this term mean? Well, so this is a stochastic partial differential equation. So just in the same sense, we study partial differential equations, and we had stochastic differential equations. This is sort of, if you like, the composite of stochastic differential equation and partial differential equation. So WT, this is like when we talked about Ito stochastic differential equations, we had some derivative of Brownian motion, which didn't really exist, but nevertheless, well, because it's not differentiable in the usual sense, but its derivative makes sense, for example, in the space of distributions, Schwarz distributions. And what this is exactly, this is mathematically precisely a generalized function, a Gaussian generalized function, which has independent increments in space and time. So just like the Brownian motion, when I took increments, the increments were independent in time. Space-time white noise, you have increments that are independent in both space and time. And in one dimension, this stochastic partial differential equation has a solution, which is continuous, jointly continuous in time and space with probability 1. But remarkably, even this simple equation, it's, of course, the question is, to what extent does this equation make sense? And so you would ask the question of existence and uniqueness. Well, it turns out this equation, it's still an open problem whether it's got a strong uniqueness property in the sense that there's, on one probability space given by the W, there's only one solution. It's an open problem. It's been one of the major open problems for the last 25 years, still, as far as I know, open. But we do have the characterization of the solution that'll also be the characterization in the higher dimensions. Well, there are many, of course. Stochastic PDE is potentially extremely important area of research. For example, wave propagation in random media corresponds to stochastic Schrodinger equation. And stochastic PDE is a big subject. Here, I wrote down a slightly different one, so-called Wright-Fisher SPDE. Again, in one dimension. And here, instead of square root of x, it's square root of x1 minus x. And that keeps the levels from getting out of hand. And this is sort of a simulation that comes from Rick Durrett that corresponds to the evolution in space and also in time. So you see, these things are rather complicated looking objects, but there are continuous functions of space and time. However, if we try to do the same thing in two dimensions, it turns out that whatever we do, we take a limit, but the limit does not have a density. It's going to be the population. Of course, you can think of this as a distribution of mass in space. And it turns out that when you take the same limit in two or higher dimensions, that the limiting object is still very well defined, but instead of being a distribution with a density function, it's a singular measure. So it's going to be a measure-valued process, but at each time with probability 1, this is going to be a singular measure. But it's still very well defined. And in fact, the nice thing about the very special structure of the branching is we can actually calculate generating functions for branching. And to characterize this particular process, we use what's called Laplace functional. So Laplace transform, of course, can characterize the probability law. If you want to characterize a random measure, which is what we're doing for a fixed t, you have to be able to calculate the Laplace transform for integrals of f, integral f x dt, for a sufficiently rich class of f. And it turns out to be that these Laplace functionals can be exactly computed in terms of the solution, in terms of the initial measure, and the solution of a relatively simple semilinear PDE, which is this little PDE here, which is of interest in its own right. So there's sort of a, to study properties of this limit, which is called super Brownian motion, it suffices to, well, for many questions we can obtain information by studying the behavior of this of this partial differential equation. And recently it's even gone back the other way, that Dynkin and Legault have actually, and others, have used information about Brownian, super Brownian motion to derive results on either the parabolic or the corresponding elliptic equation, half Laplacian u equals u squared, and sometimes in bounded domains. Well, there's another object that I'll probably need to come back to later, which is related to the super Brownian motion, which is the integrated super excursion. And this is based on the fact that this critical branching mechanism always, if you start with a finite mass, always dies. It has a finite lifetime. So it makes sense to integrate it from zero to infinity. This is still a finite quantity. And, well, I tried to say it without being totally misleading. If we start the super Brownian motion off with epsilon times delta, delta zero is just a Dirac delta mass at the origin. If we start with small mass, but we condition that this total integral is one, and then we let epsilon go to zero, we get something called this integrated super excursion, which is a mathematical object that's completely characterized from the super Brownian motion. So just to sort of give, well, this is an old simulation coming from work of Robert Adler. And you can sort of just get a flavor for it. This is in two dimensions. It shows that, well, you can see that the set of sites that are occupied, well, this, as I claim, is a set of measure zero. Anyway, some kind of relatively highly clustered distribution. You can see that also in the mass distributions. As time goes on, they're highly clustered, and for each d, these are actually, in the limit, singular measures. Okay, so that was the story of sort of trying to, in the first instance, look at populations and models distributed in space. And I'll come back to that. But I also want to look, just for the moment, I said at each, you know, we're looking at these things, and at each site, we can have some dynamics. We can have some world that's going on at each site, even without the migration. And here I'm going to look at what's the standard model of population genetics. So the idea of population genetics, so this, just think of this as now just at one site. We have N individuals. And the individuals can be of, let's say, K types, called K alleles or K types. And at some particular time, the frequencies of the K types can be P1 down to PK, of course, adding up to 1. And now the basic mechanism, of the basic kind of idealized model of population genetics is you have a series of generations. And each generation, you have a constant number of individuals. So at each generation, we have exactly n individuals. And the way you'll do this, you'll generate n individuals by multinomial sampling from the current distribution of types. And if you do that, well, you do that. But then at the next generation, of course, you now have new frequencies, and the frequencies continue to change. But at each stage, you do multinomial sampling from the previous generation. Well, it doesn't take, probably it's an elementary exercise for an undergraduate to show that if you do this, eventually all but one types will disappear. I mean, fixation types, because there's always a positive probability one type will not appear in the next generation. If you want to maintain diversity in the population, if you have this mechanism and it's a finite population, you need mutation, and that's That's the mechanism I look at now. So sort of the model, the mathematical model that sort of captures a lot of the basic ideas of population genetics is the so-called infinitely many alleles model. And the idea there is, well, the idea is, of course, if when you have a mutation, and the mutation rate's not too large and so on, a mutation is likely to give rise to a type which is different than any of the types you currently have. So the idea, the mathematical idealization is to simply to say, okay, I'm going to label types by the interval 0 to 1. I'm going to look at the finite population sampling, but every time there's a mutation, it'll correspond to the formation of a new type. So that's the basic mechanism. And the new type will be chosen. Well, we just use 0, 1 as labels, so what we're going to do is we'll simply choose the label using a uniform distribution on 0, 1. So I'll pick its new label by uniform. So that means if I do that, I'll never get the same type twice. And then if I look at the large type limit and I do the same kind of scaling I talked about in the previous thing, we're going to get something which is called the infinitely many alleles model, which is now a measure-valued diffusion process of same type as super Brownian motion, but now the state space is M1, the space of probability measures on 0, 1. So you describe the population, the distribution of types as a measure on 0, 1. And then if you sort of partition the interval 0, 1 up into k subintervals, then the distribution of those frequencies that you get in equilibrium has this Dirichlet distribution, which is, well, I've written down the formula here for the Dirichlet distribution, which is defined on the simplex, K-simplex. And that's, of course, something which plays a big role in Bayesian statistics. But, well, okay, so that was the case, of course, I just looked at if I partitioned the interval into K subintervals. But now, of course, I can now say, what happens if I let the partition size go to zero, if I let K go to infinity? Of course, then it's a little bit of a problem because, of course, you know, the question is there going to be in the limit maybe infinitely many types, and if we want to have something make sense, we have to first, before we take the limit, we have to order the types in non-increasing frequencies. So there's always a biggest. So in other words, what is the proportion of the most frequent type in the population? So if we order the types and then like k go to infinity, what we get in the limit is an order probability vector which has what we call the Poisson-Dirichlet distribution, which is, I think, one of the important mathematical objects that's arisen in the last, I guess, 30, 40 years. And I mean, this is just, again, one of those surprises, or at least it looks like a surprise first time you see it. If we now go to number theory and we look at the set of integers from 1 to n, little n, and of course we know any such integer, we can have a prime factorization, and so of course we prime factorization with multiplicities, and we can choose the primes again to be in non-increasing order. And if you like, this in some sense, the proportion of the integer contributed by the factor corresponding to the prime pi. And now if you look at these proportions of a number chosen randomly from 1 to n, in other words, you just look at the uniform measure on 1 to n and you look at the distribution under the uniform measure, you take this limit, you get exactly that Poisson-Dirichlet distribution that came from genetics. So why the distribution of alleles in a population and prime factors should have the same distribution is one of those little miracles, I guess, or perhaps suggest that there's kind of universality class corresponding to this phenomenon. And there are other combinatorial things, like, for example, in permutation, some structure in permutations also gives rise to this Poisson-Dirichlet distribution. So it's something very, very basic, I think. But we don't, it's not as well known as probably it should be. Well, that's, okay, so I'm continuing now with exactly the same model, but this model that came from population genetics is very simple, but extremely interesting and beautiful, and it's given rise. Of course, it's one of those things that, as I mentioned, is important, very much important to, in, I mean, some of these things form the foundation of methodologies for analysis of data, empirical data, but at the same time, they're a very beautiful mathematical structure. And one of those things which is an extremely important mathematical object, which I think more and more is being playing a big role in many things, of course, now it's a very standard object, is what's called the Kingman coalescent. And so the idea is let's, if we have this population I've been describing evolving in time, when I look at K, if I pick a number of individuals in the population at some time, and now I look backwards, remember this is mechanisms going on in time, this random sampling mechanism. If I look backwards, of course, in time, well, some of these individuals will have had a common parent, a common ancestor, a common parent. So the idea of the analysis of the Kingman coalescence is to take a population, look backwards at the ancestral information. So this simply says, well, these two individuals had a common ancestor, these two did, and so on. And one of the theorems is that if you just simply take this, of course, random sampling mechanism, eventually all individuals in the population will come from one common ancestor, up to the so-called last common ancestor. And the probabilistic structure of this process going backwards in time is something extremely nice. It's one of the simplest stochastic processes, pure death process, where at any one time, if you're looking at the probability that the total number of those lines, vertical lines, will decrease from k to k minus 1, it will simply be at rate k choose 2. And so it's a pure death process, eventually goes to 0. And one of the amazing things about this process, you can actually start with an infinite population, and in a finite time you already, it only takes a finite time, because of course this is like dx dt equals minus x squared. It only takes a finite time to start actually from an infinite number. So when we take the infinitely many alleles model, you can start even with infinitely many individuals in a finite time, get back to the common ancestors. And for, okay, so, and also, of course, in this Kingman coalescent, one can study many things. Like, for example, I put these little red marks here to denote where mutations may have occurred. So here, the number of, you could see that, say, this type and this type are different. You can look at where the last mutation occurred. So, so in fact, this is the picture, which is sort of the basic picture. And, of course, in the analysis of genetic data these days, one tends to look at two. You took a sample from two individuals, or maybe in the same species, maybe different species, and you look at the DNA, and you look at pairwise comparison of the beads. So the point of this model that I'll now describe is a mathematical model that allows you to compare what happens to, how to compare two individuals, how many mutations have occurred, and where they've occurred. So this is very important model, because it actually is the basis for a lot of the statistical methodology that occurs. It's called the infinitely many sites model. And there what we do is we look at the historical picture. We look, so the state of the system is now going to be a sequence of numbers between 0 and 1. All but finitely many will be zeros. And what we're going to simply keep track of is where the last mutation occurred. So, for example, the sequence X1, X2, and so on will say, I have an individual where the last mutation in the, you know, thinking of this as a kind of labeling of a DNA string, where the last mutation occurred. So, actually, mathematically, you can embed this in the previous infinitely many types models if you keep track of the histories. which is one of the basic tools that's now used in the study of these various kinds of population models, is to keep track of histories, what happened, not only where the current states and positions of individuals are, but what their previous positions were, what their previous relationships were. And a lot of genetic inference is based on these days on a combination of probabilistic models such as this, and then of course, computational tools. We need to be able to calculate likelihoods and so on. And for these, like, then you get these trees, which have a very rich structure. They have a probabilistic structure. What is the likelihood, or comparing two likelihoods? Well, that's usually done by Markov chain Monte Carlo. You're going to find a Markov chain that gives the equilibrium distribution according to the distribution of the trees that you would get from that model. Okay, well, now I'm going to return to, so we did a little bit how to go and look model populations in space, where you have migration in space and interaction at a site. And then we looked a little bit at this population, finite population sampling mutation mechanism. Well, this model is going to sort of combine these two. We're going to now come back and look at populations that are distributed in space. Of course, this is quite natural. You want to study populations, for example, how mutations spread geographically. You need a model in which you have populations that move, but also you have this whole mechanism taking place. So this so-called infinitely many type stepping stone model is one that I'm very interested in. So basically it's a little complicated, but let's just sort of quickly summarize it. So we're going to, again, the population is going to live on a d-dimensional lattice. At each lattice site, the set of potential types will be labeled by 0, 1. And the population at each site will be described, well, it'll be a population, so we'll describe it by a probability distribution on 0, 1. That'll just simply give me the distribution of the infinitely many types at a given site. And then the dynamics will be, at each site, I'll allow this finite population sampling. And in this case, I'm going to do it without mutation. So there's sort of two ways to maintain diversity in a population. One is to have mutation, but the other is to have spatial distribution and migration. So here is going to be a study of the effects of the migration. And migration is simply going to be a random walk on the d-dimensional lattice. So then this is an area where you get extremely interesting dimension-dependent behavior. So first of all, in one and two dimensions, what happens is eventually you lose the diversity. If you look at any one in a bounded region, you'll eventually only see one type, local fixation. But in three and higher dimensions, you'll have an equilibrium develop in which you see at any one time a finite or even infinitely many types present. Okay, and then I'm going to expand on this. It turns out then four is another critical dimension, which I like to explain a little bit why. So we've already seen two. Well, the reason for this, that two is a critical dimension is because the ordinary random walk is recurrent in dimensions one and two, which means that it comes back to the origin infinitely large times. Whereas in dimensions three and higher, random walk, ordinary random walk or Brownian motion is transient, which means eventually it leaves any bounded set and never returns. And that's sort of what's behind this phenomenon that the population loses diversity in one and two dimensions. So in three dimensions, of course, it's transient and we maintain this. But four dimensions is also a very interesting dimension, that something else is critical at four dimensions, which I'll try to explain. So one thing it's going to be is that the equilibrium is going to be described by a countable collection of In a minute, I'm going to show you a slide with colors, but think of this is you're going to be able to decompose the equilibrium population into subpopulations of individuals that are related, that have a common ancestor. And it turns out in the equilibrium, the mathematical infinite limit has the structure that the equilibrium distribution population can be decomposed into a countable number of families of related individuals. And in 3 and 4 dimensions, it turns out that if you then look at the movement of that infinite family in space and time, that that infinite family revisits a bounded region at arbitrarily large times. But in dimensions d bigger and higher, the infinite family essentially doesn't visit the bounded region at arbitrarily large times. So this is made more precise in the statement about homozygosity. So homozygosity is simply a measure of how, of course, we have these different types, and how much of the population corresponds to being the same type. So these are measures on 0, 1, and if we look at the measure on the diagonal, this is just on the diagonal, that'll correspond to atoms that you have in, these will be at two different sites, the J-th site and the 0th site. At those two sites, there will be individuals of the same type. And so this is a measure of the amount of homozygosity in a region of size L, and just it's always true in equilibrium that that thing goes to zero. So it says that in this kind of equilibrium, each family contributes in the limit a zero density to the total, to the total population. And this is then the result that corresponds to five, if and only if, I guess this should say d bigger than or equal to 5. It says that, again, this is sort of a way that corresponds to like when we define transience recurrence. It simply says the amount of homozygosity is integrable in 5 and higher dimensions. So it's an effect that comes from, and you might think, well, 5 dimensions is not interesting, but of course we're talking about phenotype space, so these spaces can be very high dimensional. And what is, okay, so what is the role of dimension and why? So basically, I mentioned already that in 1 and 2 dimensions, random walk is recurrent. So what is now the key point about 4 dimensions? Well, it turns out there's another property, another critical property that happens at 5 dimensions. And that's that in 3 and 4 dimensions, random walk is transient, but not strongly transient. By strongly transient means, if it's transient, if B is a bounded region, so what this represents is a little typo here. This is going to be the last exit time from a ball of origin 0 and radius 1. So I look at a ball, and I look at the last time I leave the ball. Well, if it's transient, it's going to say, with probability 1, that's a finite random variable. Strong transience means that the expected last time to leave the ball is finite. And this strong transience corresponds to, in fact, you have strong transience in D plus epsilon dimension. So when we can go to this fractional dimension, it's actually D equals 4 is the critical dimension for strong transience. Okay. Well, just very quickly, spend a few more minutes just on the very last section, which is to return to this idea of universality classes. And, you know, we studied universality classes of distributions on the real line. And now we're studying in more recent times these spatial and space-time structures. So it's sort of interesting to know, are there some kind of universality effects taking place there? And the answer seems to be yes. There's at least certain classes, certain, if you like, domains of attraction of certain basic objects. And the basic objects I'll mention here are super Brownian motion that we've described, and this integrated ISE, this integrated super excursion, which is the integral 0 infinity of super Brownian motion. And well, I just mentioned here in passing that, you know, each one of these objects has kind of a structure. And in high dimensions, this integrated super excursion actually is supported on a set of dimension 4 in all higher in all dimensions 4 and higher. And then there's the most recent addition to this business is what's called the class of stochastic Lerner evolution. So there's some emerging universality phenomenon taking place in space and space-time. So the first one I mentioned is now the idea that super Brownian motion, which is this rather simple canonical object, actually corresponds to a universality class, and there's evidence that quite a number of things looked at in large space and time scales basically share the large-scale behavior of super Brownian motion, and in some very precise way, in the large-scale limit, they become, they converge to super Brownian motion. So these are very nice results, recent results of Cox, Durrett, and Perkins, and Bramson, Cox, and Legall, slightly different results, but I'll just try to explain. So remember, the Voder model was a model at each site was either a 0 or a 1. And at some rate, each individual would pick one of the neighbors and switch to the opinion of the neighbor. So it's a rather nice but simple model. And now the idea here is if I now look, I think the simple, I'm going to say something slightly different than what's said there. If I now look at the infinite, we can also introduce the infinitely many types Voder model, where at time zero you just say every site has a different color or a different opinion. And now what we're going to do is we're going to trace the set of sites that have the same opinion as the individual at the origin. And it turns out that when we rescale this collection of sites, we do this kind of same kind of mass space-time mass rescaling for the set of sites which have an opinion which corresponds to the site of an individual at the origin, that thing actually converges to an object coming from super Brownian motion, a version of super Brownian motion. So and of course one gets the sense that in fact there's now several different classes of particle systems that converge to that same process. Well, just to give you a flavor of what goes on, so this is, if you start with each site, well, of course, there's a finite number of colors, I guess, here. But anyway, you start with each site with a different color, and that's not really quite done here. I guess this is some kind of finite number of colors. And you let it evolve. Of course, what happens is you get these various regions building out. Some colors will die out, and some of these colors will spread out and become fairly large regions. And roughly speaking, what it's saying is if I look at one of these regions, here, if we look at, say, the red clusters, so that's going to be the set of individuals who have a common ancestor. And the green individuals will be all individuals that have, you look at these random geometrical structures, they converge in this sense to something which comes from super Brownian motion, something called the Palm cluster. So I think, well, it turns out, and I don't have time to do it, but it turns out that in high dimensions, certain objects that come from percolation theory, which is an object that comes from statistical physics, also converges to, in fact, that was discovered here at the Fields, well, partially worked on at the Fields Institute in the year on probability and its applications, Gordon Slade, Eric Derbez, and worked by this, were the first to do this sort of thing, and also, of course, Ed Perkins, who is a world expert in super processes. So, okay. Well, maybe I'm just going to move on now in the very last minute to looking at future challenges. So I think essentially we've experienced a period of time where we had a very rich development of these more complicated stochastic models. And now, of course, it's really going to be the test, can we really somehow, it seems to be the where the best hope would be to kind of use this richness that we can potentially work and to take advantage both of the power of simulation and some of these analytical scale, large-scale effects and universality effects to try to get information about the behavior of more complex systems of interacting agents in a random environment and so on. It's potentially a big subject. And just one very final thing. I guess the idea, there has been, some of these things have now become to be realized. Some very beautiful work of Cox and Greven in trying to make mathematically precise the notion of the relation between infinite systems and finite systems. So roughly speaking, the conclusions of their work is that if I look at a big box, you know, I'm looking at the lattice, but if I look at a box, and because they want to switch it into a finite system, they look at, in fact, the torus. So they turn the periodic boundary conditions, and they study the system on the finite system. And then you can ask the question, to what extent does that finite system on the torus describe what's going on in the infinite system, or vice versa? And it turns out that what happens is in certain time scale, the two systems are the same. And then in other time scales, the systems may be very different. And it turns out, once again, what happens as these time scales change depends very much on whether you're in low dimensions or in high dimensions. But one is beginning to get some understanding of the mechanisms and the relations between finite and infinite systems. And even this scheme gives us at least some kind of, if you like, a sandbox to play in to test some of these ideas of universality, because there's a sort of a framework in which Andreas Greven and myself have a way of formulating mathematically precise the notion of universality class in a very simple setting, but then getting some rigorous results. So, thank you.